I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with George Dvorsky. George is a dear old friend and a fellow of my Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, our Institute for... Actually, you're not a fellow. You're a board member, but you've become... You started to act like a fellow because you started writing so much.
I'm on the board, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So he's a board member of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and was on the board of the World Transhumanist Organization, one of the founding board members of that. And so welcome, George.
Thank you, Jay.
George, you have always been a very sterling example of the public engaged and quite eclectic intellectual. And recently, your life has opened up again, and you've got the opportunity to start writing about stuff. So we're going to talk about a whole range of different topics that you've addressed in recent articles. But I want to first mention Sentient Developments, which is your podcast and blog. And why don't you tell people how they can find Sentient Developments, because all of your stuff is there.
Sure. I started the Sentient Developments blog back in 2002. So I've been blogging for quite some time now, and it's always been under the name Sentient Developments, although it's been under a number of different, I guess, front ends in terms of how I've been able to actually enter the blog items themselves. Most recently, I've migrated the blog over to Blogspot, which is an excellent service. So all you need to do is just key in sentientdevelopments.blogspot.com. And of course, being the technophile that I am, and many transhumanists are early adopters, I'm also now into the whole podcast thing, which to me is an absolute wonderful way to, again, use the technologies at hand for, basically conveying my thoughts and my concerns and even putting down interviews and using new media. And it's just wonderful that anyone in their living room can put together a fairly decent production of an audio cast and put it out there on the web for anyone to download in MP3 format.
One of the articles that you wrote recently, you've written a couple articles about virtual worlds, and there's always been an expectation or a hope that as VR developed and more realistic communication and instantiation of avatars developed, that we would be able to develop more realistic relationships and communication inside these worlds. Do you think that that's beginning to happen? Is that what you see happening?
Yeah, actually, I very much do, although I don't necessarily think that we're there quite yet. I have also been experimenting with Second Life and kind of doing a bit of preliminary research for my talk at the Stanford event in May, where I'll be talking about potential issues as they surround to the expansion of personhood. I'm speaking specifically to that. Well, will we ever see the day where we can legitimately say that our online presence has as much personhood, moral worth, as we do here in the real world? So what I did, I downloaded Second Life, installed it, and created a character for myself and started walking around the bizarre world that Second Life is. And I actually left the experience a little less than enthusiastic about the whole thing. But that's only in terms of, I think, where the technology is today. That has absolutely no bearing on where I think this will be in a few years from now. I think that, by all means, a virtual world and a virtual working environment will vastly be superior to just text-based communications in terms of being able to interact with one another. I know that Giulio Prisco, for example, is going to be organizing an event where he's going to be speaking about transhumanism in Second Life, and I thought that's so extraordinary. And that's, again, a good example of where perhaps this virtual world can transcend the limitations of text-based email. But as you mentioned, Jay, the another aspect of this is will a virtual world result in a more legitimate form of personal expression? And the first thing that happens to you when you get into Second Life is you start to obsess over your physical appearance, and you end up spending an inordinate amount of time adjusting your cheekbone level, the color of your pants, and so on. And I know that I spent a ridiculous amount of time just making sure that I wanted to look exactly the way that I looked. But it really, then I kind of took a step back and asked myself, what is it that I'm doing? Why do I feel this is so important? And I realized that, well, this is the whole thing about a virtual world, and even when it comes to modifying technologies here in the real world, is it is a venue for one to least give them a venue for where they can properly reinvent themselves and express themselves in the way that they see fit. While I never was able to perfectly, you know, achieve my avatar, I never nailed my avatar down exactly where I wanted it to, it did get me thinking that, you know what, I can actually express myself in this world physically far better than I really can in the real world. I mean, my genetic makeup is very specific, and I had nothing to do over my genetic constitution. But here in the virtual world, I can look exactly the way I want to do, the way I want to be, and in a way, it is a form of self-actualization that is probably impossible here in the real world. So, again, given more advanced communications, better graphics, better means to communicate with each other in these virtual worlds, I can see it most certainly being perhaps a heightened way for humans to interact with each other that will perhaps at some level never match the sophistication and intimacy of real human-to-human contact in the real world. But at the same time, I think it might just actually represent a new form of person-to-person communication where we may not be so inhibited because of our physical appearance, but we're actually quite confident in the ways that we look and the ways that we can express ourselves in terms of the settings and our appearances in these virtual worlds.
Well, one of the forms of self-expression that's happening in the virtual worlds and in Second Life in particular is gender play. And there are people making and selling designer genitalia. There are sex emporiums in Second Life. There are places where, S&M emporiums where you can go and have an S&M experience. And there's mature areas where kids aren't allowed. Recently, there was a controversy because apparently there's some age play going on where people are pretending to be pedophiles and with other adults.
Oh, wow.
And the question is, should that be allowed in Second Life and things like that? But you have written about post-genderism, and this seems to be a nice segue into that topic because you got this Wikipedia entry that you've been vigorously defending at Wikipedia to defend this idea. What's your idea there?
Well, the idea of post-genderism, I don't think it's highly original. I think it's really a variant on some of the things that the cyborg feminist Donna Haraway had to say back in the early 80s. But I think that perhaps where I've taken it in a different area is that Donna Haraway was speaking specifically to feminist-based issues and was speaking specifically to women and in the ways that women can use enhancement technologies, particularly cybernetic technologies, to truly emancipate themselves. Haraway's issue was, and her form of feminism was such that she felt that as long as women remain as reproductive units, as kind of the integral instrument for the ongoing survival and procreation of the species, they would forever and ever be subjugated. And that only until the shackles of their biology were removed could women finally achieve true liberation. So I don't believe she specifically used the terminology post-gender or post-genderism. I think she obviously chose to use the term cyborg instead, or hinting at a post-biological entity. I do think that that's where the idea originated.
Of course, our IET Board of Advisors member, Martine Rothblatt, wrote the book, The Apartheid of Gender, where she argues for post-genderism as well as a legal concept, that we should get rid of all legal distinctions around gender.
In fact, reading Haraway, it got me thinking as well as, obviously not as a woman reading this, but as a man thinking this and wondering how can something like this apply to me as a man? And at the same time that I was into Haraway, I was also very much into perhaps a less known area of philosophical thought, and that is the area of what's called masculism. Now, masculism is not masculinism, which is kind of a group of woman haters that are pure reactionaries to the effects of feminism. Masculism takes a more tempered approach to gender-based issues and takes a step back and asks, just in which ways does gender impact on to the detriment of both men and women? And in which ways do gender roles, in fact, enhance our relationships, both with partners and with family members and so forth. And it tries to take a stripped-down look at individuals and how both gender that is both physically and psychologically ingrained, and how those gender attributes that are sociologically ingrained both work to the benefit and disadvantage of people. So it got me thinking again, the intertwining Haraway's idea with masculist ideas, that really what we should be talking about is in fact a post-genderist future, where we can in fact remove those elements of our gender that we do find are to our detriment. And Jay, one time you said something to me that has forever stuck to me, and that is, for example, you said testosterone kills. And it's disturbingly apt observation. And I, especially, you know, here in Toronto where we're having gun issues, and every time I hear about a 16-year-old boy who was gunned down by another 16-year-old boy, I think to myself, testosterone kills. Because we're not hearing about girls shooting each other. We're not hearing about 15 and 17-year-old girls getting into their cars and racing at extreme speeds down the street only to smash into a telephone pole and kill themselves. Obviously, I mean, I'm perhaps focusing on adolescence here, but I do think that testosterone issues and other male issues that are self-destructive, even potentially abusive, stick with men, throughout their entire lives.
Your discourse, your ideas here are also being explored in the gay and transgender community, because there's a lot of people in those communities who are trying to reclaim gender play and gendered roles and the ability to explore the extremes of feminine expression and male expression in positive ways. And the same political questions are raised. Is that a reinforcement of all the negative aspects of patriarchy, or is that in fact empowering when a woman can be a drag king and right. Act like a guy for a while?
Except that in my discussions with those in those movements, particularly those within the transsexual movement, not that really could be described as a movement, as it is a group of people actually self-actualizing themselves based on what they feel is their true physiological self. When I've addressed the issues of post-genderism to them and the idea of actually there being post-biological existence or a non-gendered existence, the reaction has been overwhelmingly negative. And the reason, at least as best as I can tell, is that these are individuals who have been very much focused on the achievement of a specific gender and the achievement of very specific gender roles and ways in which they can express themselves that meets their expectations of how they want to be. And to suddenly tell someone that actually, no, let's move away from gender, it seems kind of antithetical to a certain degree. Because as I continue to kind of articulate these thoughts in my mind about what post-genderism actually means, there is a part of me that is very much saying that post-genderism is exactly that, that it is the elimination of gender for future individuals. And I'm talking truly about post-biological organisms that are non-gender specific. And again, back to the masculist train of thought, at the same time that psychologically we would want to retain those characteristics from our biological heritage that are positive. In other words, what are those things about being a man that are inherently positive? And what are those things about being a woman that are inherently positive? And let's retain those things. And while at the same time rejecting those things about both gender roles and gender expectations and how gender affects our psychology, those things that are to our detriment, we will discard those elements.
I recently sent around that Buddhist bioethics essay that I had commissioned from the Encyclopedia of Bioethics. And at the key, one of the key aspects, as you are also a Buddhist or interested in Buddhism.
That's right.
And one of the key aspects, as you know, of Buddhist ethics is this integration of compassion and wisdom. And of course, the Buddhist iconography and understanding of these issues has always had a gendered dimension to it. Like in Tibetan iconography, you have the bell and the Dorje being a symbol of compassionate action, and the bell being a symbol of emptiness. And so there's always been this interplay of masculine and feminine in our understanding of these things. Well, when you get over into Western ethics, there's this discourse around Carol Gilligan saying that women reason from a place of compassion, and men reason from a place of principles and moral reasoning. And I think, when you put it in that kind of context, you can see there has to be an integration of these things. You can't have moral reasoning without compassion. You can't have compassion without moral reasoning. You can't have the wisdom without the compassion. So absolutely. I mean, I think we need to break down these arbitrary dimensions and integrate these things in ways they haven't before.
And I think here in the West as well, there is, a big emphasis on the importance of, gender pairing off of two people of the the opposite gender. And you really see this in the gay marriage debate. And the idea that, and again, a similar kind of idea that was recently expounded by the Pope in his recent statement, the idea that the true family unit, and as a consequence, the community and society itself is dependent on that heterosexual pairing, that it is through the female role and the male role and their ability to not just interact with each other, but what it then speaks to their ability to raise a child and to be part of a community is paramount, that you can't mess with that. And I know that this has been expressed by some who are opposed to gay marriage, the idea that embarking on in a world where we have two men raising a family or two women raising a family, that it is a bizarre and dangerous social experiment, and as a place that we shouldn't go, because it's a potential form of child abuse. And it's one that I reject out of hand. To me, that is an explicit form of homophobia. It is completely undermining the ability of responsible gay parents to raise children. And at the same time, it's the fetishization of the heterosexual union. And
it's a biology as destiny's argument, because the argument, as you point out, is that a woman can't provide masculine features of that is associated with a father role, you know, and that's absurd. What both men and women can provide both male and female aspects of parenting to a child.
Yes, I put these ideas all kind of together in this post-gender argument. What I probably should do is do exactly what Donna Haraway did, and that is actually put this down into a coherent statement or a manifesto and get it out there. What I did was kind of tried to cheat a little bit, and I put a quick article together and posted it on Wikipedia, and I think I was probably fairly criticized in doing that, as that's really not the purpose of Wikipedia. The purpose of Wikipedia is to enter already established encyclopedic references, enter encyclopedic references to already established ideas. So I believe the article is still there, but I don't expect it to be there for too much longer. Been regarded as a neologism, but I just have to get my act together and I think put this down into a more cogent and coherent statement.
One of the other issues that you've been much more forthright about than most people in the transhumanist movement, and that is even a little bit problematic for me, is your advocacy of animal rights. I've been fairly explicit about the kind of hierarchy of being that I would like to see enacted into law. But I think you are a little bit more radical than me in believing in the moral authority or the moral importance of vegetarianism and stopping factory farming and things like that. You're a little bit more of a Peter Singerite. Do I characterize your position correctly?
Absolutely. I'm very much influenced by the writings of Peter Singer. I don't agree with everything that he has to say in regards to our treatment of non-human animals. For example, he even finds the idea of having pets as being morally incorrect, as in some way being demeaning to the animal. And I don't agree. I think there is a lot that can be gained from the relationship that one would have with a pet. I think both the pet and the human actually get a lot out of that relationship and of that interaction, and no one is necessarily demeaned by that relationship. That being said, Peter Singer has had a massive influence on my thinking in terms of how we need to be treating non-human animals. In conjunction with that, Buddhism has really opened my eyes to what is meant by the compassion for all sentient creatures. And of course, my work in transhumanism and thinking forward and thinking about the advent of different types of persons, artificial persons, humans that have transcended human biology to such a degree that they can no longer be considered Homo sapiens, and what does that mean in terms of the expansion of personhood rights in that direction? And really what it all boils down to is my belief in non-anthropocentric personhood theory. I think one cannot look to the future and to more advanced forms of personhood without looking into some of the more, at the risk of using this word, more primitive forms of personhood. And I have perhaps taken the idea of personhood and the respective experiential existence to places that perhaps even some animal rights people are reluctant to. For example, there's discussion about cows and goats, who are regarded as some of the most unintelligent creatures on the planet, although that's actually highly debatable topic right there. But let's just assume for a moment that the cow is as dumb as everybody says it is, that actually does not manage to fulfill many personhood criteria. And I think, for example, of Fletcher's personhood criteria, which is a really good starting point to discuss some of these issues. Let's just assume for a moment that the cow cannot, imagine itself too far into the future, that it cannot make plans, that to a certain degree it cannot really, be self-reflective about itself and its existence. One thing is undeniable about that organism, though, is that it is experiential. It undeniably experiences emotions. It unquestioningly has interactions with its fellow cattle. It experiences its day unlike any other creature. It grazes, it chews its cud, and it does what it's supposed to do in terms of a cow living its life. And I also know from anecdotally speaking that when it comes time for cattle to head toward the slaughter and the killing floor, that there is a general sense of panic in amongst these creatures. What I'd like to basically see in regards to all this is not necessarily, there's discussion about expanding personhood to some of the higher mammals like elephants, the gorillas, and even whales and dolphins, which I think is wonderful and definitely should probably be done. But if we could maybe not create a person category, but certainly create another category for an animal that they're given moral weight, that would be what I've called experiential organisms that are deserving of our moral consideration. So things like cows and chickens and goats. And of course, I'm mentioning farm animals only because they're within our custodial responsibility. We have factory farms and where these animals are produced and abused and for human consumption. And that, I think, is something I would really like to see more work on in the future to protect their rights. And recently, I was encouraged to see in the papers that there's been great advances made in terms of our ability to create synthetic meat. This is basically meat that's grown in a petri dish. And I'm sure many among the meat eaters listening right now are probably wincing a bit, and rightfully so. I can only imagine, the aesthetic value of eating meat out of a petri dish. But I can only imagine that these sorts of things will be, I guess, more refined over time. And again, one of the big issues right now is to be able to produce this kind of synthetic meat in factory format for mass production. But really, the point I'm getting at with all this is that, I haven't eaten meat in quite some time, and I consider myself to be a very healthy person. Meat is not a necessary part of our diet. It's a superfluous thing. It's an affluent thing, and it is to the detriment of the non-human animals, as far as I'm concerned. So it's an immoral act. And whereas at one time our survival was perhaps dependent upon hunting and eating of meat, it most certainly is not an integral part of our survival today. And further, with the advent of artificial meat, there are now alternatives. So the idea of having factory farms and raising livestock has become even less justifiable and will continue to become less justifiable over time.
George, we have to bring this to a close, but one last topic where I know that we share a common passion, and that's Battlestar Galactica. You recently wrote an article about the science of Battlestar Galactica. And, isn't this just the most rockin' show on TV? When I recently flipped across the channel to Star Trek Next Generation, which my wife and I used to passionately watch every single time it was on. And, I was a big fan of that when it was on. But when you compare the gritty reality, the level of West Wing politics that happens in Battlestar Galactica, the tensions between the military and the civilians and black markets and prostitution and all the things that they address there, that were just completely off the radar for earlier generations of science fiction. It's a really amazing show, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's, in fact, a very encouraging sign. Science fiction on television has it's had its high and low moments over its history. And definitely Star Trek, right, from the original Roddenberry series, and most obviously, particularly with the 1980s and early 90s version, was a very important in terms of science fiction. Books have been written, and I've actually got a number on my shelf. There's the physics of Star Trek. There's the ethics of Star Trek, the metaphysics of Star Trek. And rightfully so. I mean, these episodes, even in my own writings, I will definitely drop allusions to some episodes or some incidences because I think they're definitely relevant to philosophical discussion or a point that you're trying to make. But one thing that was definitely lacking in Star Trek was that kind of gritty realness that you're seeing in Battlestar Galactica. You're right, it is very much a West Wing kind of set in space, and I think that's kind of this post 9/11 world that we now live in, which is very much on edge and high melodrama, and people are, you know, I guess their sensibilities are a little bit more severe than they were in the 80s and the 90s with Star Trek. So it's definitely speaking to people that way. But one thing I think is still missing in television science fiction, and even in Hollywood science fiction as well, is really the conveyance of transhumanist and futurist themes as they are in literature these days. I think literature is still very much where it's at. Egan and others have certainly are describing those things that I think are in terms of the genre of science fiction having a social purpose as a speculative fiction. I think that the written word is where it's at. Where I'd like to see Battlestar Galactica perhaps get to are, in fact, some issues, but I don't think they're going to do this. Or will be issues of, you know, enhancement technologies and procreative freedoms, and although they may actually very well be getting there with the Cylons and uploading, because that's a direct issue that you know pertains to transhumanists in terms of the ability to transfer one's thoughts to a different substrate.
Yeah, the medicine in Battlestar Galactica is 20th century medicine. They don't have any life extension or any of that stuff.
No.
But they do seem to be dancing around the issue of a transhuman rights framework, because there's been these issues around, is it okay to torture this machine? When do the machines have moral rights? When should they be considered prisoners of war and things like that?
That is true, and I'd like to see them take it to even further extremes and to further make it relevant, at least as far as where the important discussions are at. And I think it's important because, take Star Trek, for example, people, they tend to take the Star Trek universe for granted and take it as gospel, and they imagine that, you know what, this is actually a foreshadowing of where humanity will be centuries down the line. We'll be, you know, utterly human, riding in spaceships, traveling around the galaxy. And that's utterly not true. I think in the 24th century, we will most certainly not be humans traveling around in spaceships around the galaxy. And I think that it's important that our fiction kind of relay, even if it is fiction, at least give us some kind of a speculative aspect that's grounded in some kind of reality. And I've always been a fan of the more hard versions of science fiction that tend to be rooted more in scientific fact.
George, it's been a delight talking to you as always, and I look forward to seeing you at the Human Enhancement Technologies
Absolutely.
And Human Rights Conference, May 26th to 28th at Stanford University. And tell us again what you're going to be talking about there.
My topic is tentatively titled Me, Myself, and I, Personhood, Issues, and Ethics in the Age of the Distributed Self. So the idea that will you at some point in your life be able to say you are not just one person, but you are a multiplicity of persons, each with their own set of rights to protect them.
Excellent. Looking forward to that.
Thank you.
See you very soon.
Cheers, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.